This is KDLG's Bristol Band Beyond. Welcome to our special spooky Halloween episode. This week we will depart from the realm of the normal and the known, at least what some people assume they know. Join us as we revisit a few of the mysterious creatures and legends of local lore and tradition. Those like Hairy Man, who many have seen, even very recently.
And so I put my hands on my wife's shoulders and I whispered in her ear, "That's not a bear." And she said, "Well, what is it?" And I said, "I think that's Hairy Man." And she says, "I want to go home now."
While Hairy Man is mysterious, it never seems to be malicious. That's not true of the little people, especially they that used to live there between Clark's Point and Ekuk.
From my understanding, they were very, very mischievous, very, very evil.
Another story that has kept kids and more than a few adults from straying too far from camp at night is that of Stukpuk, the long-nailed lady who came to a fondness for the taste of children after she ate her own.
So the kid came over, and she clunked him over the head and threw him in the pot and cooked him up. And she ate him, and he tasted really good. And they say because it's human flesh, you just can't get enough of it. And she was still hungry. So she called her other child in, and she did the same thing.
Over the next hour, we'll explore those creatures, plus medicine men, ghosts, and thunderbirds. The longer, dare I say, creepier nights are upon us, and things are going bump out there. Do you know what you believe about the creatures roaming the wide tundra, the deep forests, and the vast lakes that surround us? Whether you think you do or not, you're not going to want to turn that dial, and you may not want to listen alone. This is our Halloween special, Bristol Bay and Beyond, on KDLG.
Cadence Dre, I'm in fifth grade.
Caitlin Johansson, I'm in fifth grade.
There was an old woman, all skin and bones, who lived near the graveyard all alone. Ooh, she thought she'd go to church one day to hear the parson preach and pray. Ooh. And when she came to the church house aisle, she thought she'd stop and rest a while. Ooh. When she came up to the door, she thought she'd stop and rest some more. Ooh. But when she turned and looked around, she saw a corpse upon the ground. Ooh. From its nose down to its chin, the worms crawled in and the worms crawled out. Ooh, the woman to the preacher said, "Shall I look like that when I'm dead?" Ooh, the preacher to the woman said, "You'll look like that when you are dead." Ah!
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. I'm Dave Benninger, and my thanks this week to a host of elementary school youngsters who will help keep things light as we move through this hour, including these two jokesters, August Ray and Henry Stelling.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Wayne.
Wayne who?
Wayne, can I eat my Halloween candy?
When your parents say you can, little buddy. More knock knocks from that comedic powerhouse and more stories along the way this hour. But let's begin with a good Hairy Man story. Well, two, actually. You see, I asked Chris Maines of Dillingham to take me to a spot he had had an unusually close encounter with a Hairy Man just a month ago. And he agreed. But on the way there, he shared first a story of his dad's encounter with a Hairy Man. This was back in the 70s. Chris says his dad was upriver at a cabin on a solo trip to dig an outhouse. He had gotten the hole dug and called it a day and turned in for the night. Well, at least that was the plan. Something outside the cabin was scratching, and something about that scratching just definitely didn't seem right.
Having been in that cabin myself as a kid, you know, you get squirrels and stuff climbing all over the place, but it was like a persistent kind of scratching. But he paid no mind to it and just kind of went back to sleep. But, you know, the scratching noise just continued throughout the evening, and it got closer to where his head was laying in that bed. And so he got up and he started looking around, and he didn't see anything, so he ended up laying back down again. And after he laid back down, he heard the scratching noise, you know, coming from the window. Now, there's only one window in this cabin, so he crept across the floor kind of on all fours and grabbed his flashlight. And he followed the scratching noise all the way up to the window and clicked on the flashlight, and he was met with a big pair of brown eyes that caused him to jump backwards because he thought, you know, it must be a bear. And whatever it was, you know, kind of ran off too. And my dad was laying there on the floor trying to figure out what's going on, and he started getting ready. And all of a sudden he started hearing a screaming noise, kind of like a person screaming. And so he got dressed, grabbed his 30-06, put on his boots and walked out the door, and he kept hearing the screaming noise. It turns out this thing had fallen down into the outhouse hole. And so he saw this thing at the bottom of this 10-foot deep hole, and it was kind of like in a fetal position, and it had a bunch of shrews climbing all over it because the shrews that had been running across in the evening kind of fell in this hole. And so my dad kind of felt sorry, so he pulled out a ladder and he put it in there, and he stepped back, and this thing climbed up the ladder and stood there for about a minute or two. He said it seemed like forever that it stood there, and then it took off into the woods. So my dad, being all jazzed up now, finally goes to bed. You know, it took him a while to wind down, but he woke up the next morning, went to the hole trying to figure out, man, did this really happen? The ladder's still down there. And after he got done, you know, making his breakfast that morning, he looked at the tree line because something seemed kind of out of place, and there it was, standing at the tree line. He said it was about 6 feet tall, and, you know, it kind of seemed like it was silently thanking him.
Okay, so that was decades ago, and a story, though a good one, but secondhand, like many. But Chris Maines told me he just saw Hairy Man for the first time himself this fall, in September, during the moose hunting season. We drove up to the spot this week, just past mile marker 12 on Electinget Lake Road.
This is it?
Yep.
Not that far from town.
Mm-mm. Never are. I mean, heck, if bears can come to town, you'd be surprised what else could be out here.
It was late in the fall moose hunting season. He says he'd been hunting hard and thus far with no success and always in the mornings. So Maines changed up routine and had his wife drop him off on a breezy evening. He showed me where he hiked in to hunt that night.
And so I trekked back out to the flats, and it's just right down here. You can see that a lot of people use this trail.
Every hunter knows that one's senses are heightened in the field. Maines was listening intently for responses to his moose calling. No bulls came forward, but then, just at dusk, something did catch his eye.
I started hearing some cracking noises coming from the trees at the tree line, and I thought, well, great, a bull's finally going to come out. I'm not going to be able to really see what I'm shooting at. But I was still really curious, so I stood right out there, right in the middle of that muck, in the middle of the clearing. And it was about that time I had noticed something about, you know, 25 yards down near that tree right there. It was kind of interesting because all the other trees at the tree line were kind of moving because of the wind, but this thing was just standing still, and it didn't seem like the wind was phasing it.
It was too dark to continue hunting, so Maine says he hiked back up towards the road for a pickup.
But yeah, you know, it's strange, like, it looks a lot different at night, as, you know, most things do. I mean, right now it looks pretty peaceful. There's nothing around. You're not hearing anything. But when there's leaves on the trees and the wind's blowing and all you can smell is, you know, dying cranberries, it just gives a different kind of, like, setting to the whole thing. So I came under the tree at the end of the trail, and my wife was parked right where we are right now. and she had stepped out. She was still in the vehicle. She had moved to the passenger seat. She was on her cell phone. So when I came up out of the woods, I knocked on the window, and she kind of freaked out a little bit. I guess I would have too.
Dusk had given way to a warm autumn night, and husband and wife stood outside for a minute, recounting the hunting effort. Chris says his wife said she thought she'd heard something close by. It made some noises, maybe a response to his moose call.
And, you know, I was finishing up my coffee, and she was looking towards me, and all of a sudden she spotted something right here off the side of the road. And so she circled to the passenger side of the vehicle, and she stood right here, and right in this spot, what would you say that is, 25, 30 feet away?
Uh-huh.
She sees something reflecting off of her cell phone light, like a pair of eyes. And I turned over to see what she was, you know, gawking at. And I saw it too, and she said, "Do you see that?" And I was seeing what she was seeing, but I didn't want to admit I was seeing it. I kind of wanted to see what she thought. I said, "See what?" And she said, "There's eyes right there." And so I came beside her, and I stood right next to her, and we were both looking at it at the same time. And this thing was just crouched. The more and more I looked at it, the face was all wrong. It didn't look right. The eyes were too close together. It had no snout, and it wasn't breathing. And so I put my hands on my wife's shoulders, and I whispered in her ear, "That's not a bear." And she said, "Well, what is it?" And I said, "I think that's Harry, man." And she says, "I want to go home now." So she hopped into the passenger seat, and I circled around to the driver's side seat, and I grabbed my gun, but I kept my door open. And all of a sudden, I heard a big bang on the back of our RAV4. And it kind of shook the car a little bit. So I turned on the engine, and the moment I fired up the engine and the rear lights came on, I see this thing, you know, on two legs, sprint down the trail you and I just came up from. So I shut the door and we started to drive home, and the entire ride home, she was just frantic. She couldn't believe what she had just seen. And, you know, we had a discussion, and I told her, half the people we tell this to are going to think we're crazy, and the other half are going to believe us. But at least her and I know exactly what we saw that night. I just know that I'm never going to forget it.
You had a minute to look at it face to face, even though it was dark. What was your sense of its intent?
The scariest thing of it, you know, at least in my mind, wasn't the fact that it looked like it wanted to do anything. It was just the fact that it was observing. The fact that it saw my wife and I talking, it knew that we were looking right at it. And it did nothing. It just stayed crouched down, just looking right at us. You know, it had no fear, no sense of urgency to it. It was just watching. And that was the most unsettling part of the whole situation, just the fact that it was just watching.
You're listening to the special Halloween edition of KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond, back after this.
My name's Ashlyn, and I'm in third grade.
The 13th night of Halloween. On the 13th night of Halloween, my mommy gave to me 13 thirsty vampires, 12 ghosts a ghosting, 11 witches witching, 10 demons dancing, 9 werewolves waiting, 8 marching mutants, 7 goblins, 6 corpse, caroling, 5 singing skulls, 4 icky eyeballs, 3 baseball bats, a 2-headed snake, and a bright shiny skeleton key.
If there's a legend around here that gives people the heebies more than the rest, it must be the little people. This week, a number of grown adults, who will remain nameless at least for now, shuddered when I asked if they had any little people stories they'd like to recall. Now, little people seem to be present in many parts of Alaska, and much ink has been devoted to their mischievous or malicious ways by many people. They are not to be trifled with, say some. Others say they are to blame for many hunters who never made it back. There's a spot a particularly bad bunch of them used to inhabit between Clark's Point and Ecuc Beach. Here's our old friend Tim Troll from the KDLG series Our Story with more.
Sophie Woods recounted the legend of the little people at Clark's Point for the Dillingham High School History and Folklore class in their publication called The Story Knife, printed in 1975. And in that publication, Sophie notes that the little people at Clark's have big heads and that they are mean. They could tear up a dog in a few minutes and probably a person in the same time. They are known to have real long fingernails and big heads, and they would go around and steal fish from the racks and do a lot of little mean things to people. The bluff was all straight, but there were cracks in the bluff and caves inside where the little people lived. Now, one day, a medicine man tricked all those little people into going down into the cracks and caves. Then he turned the hill around where all the cracks and caves were and covered them up. The place where the little people were sealed in is now a large grassy area. But over the years, with winters of snow and ice, they say that place is opening up again. For people have seen little men recently.
Good luck getting those that have seen them recently to share about it. I was glad to have Steve Wassily, who grew up over there, sit down with me this week to share some about what he remembers the elders imparting on the younger generation. Tell me what you know about the little people.
Well, what I know about the little people, I was told when I was a young kid. We were told by our parents and relatives and other people in the village. A bunch of us kids used to get around. We didn't have TV like they do today. We didn't have what kids have today to play with. We had to make our own toys or listen to the radio or listen to the elders tell stories. And they used knobbly boards, you know. But anyway, when it came to about the little men, from my understanding, they were very, very mischievous, very, very evil. It sounded scary. I don't know how to tell a scary story about the little men, but they were little, and when they want to be seen, they'll let you see them. When they don't want to be seen, you can't see them.
Where did they live at the time, the little people?
I don't know, but there's a place that, from what my parents told us, that the medicine men, they call the shamans, tricked the little men and going into the bluff underground, a place called the Lukahuyak, between Clark's and Ecock. But we were also told, too, that someday the little men were going to come back. So I don't know. I've heard people say they've seen them, but...
Since then,
but I haven't myself seen any little men, and I hope I don't.
How come?
Well, because from what I was told, they're actually evil, and I know they sound mischievous. They'll play or whatever to get your attention. And
these were not welcome members of the community there.
No.
Nobody wanted to see them.
I don't think so.
Why were they evil? What do you remember? What are some of the stories you remember hearing?
The way that they told the stories was that they, you know, they were like magical, or they like don't have to be touching the ground or whatever. They can do stuff that I don't, like I said, I haven't encountered them. I just heard. And to me, you know, when you're little, you're small, you know, you're listening to scary stories, so it's, you know, you use your imagination. It's pretty scary. But I know one thing, I was told that if they want you to see, they'll let you see them, but if they don't,
What did your parents and grandparents tell you was their motivation for their either mischievousness or evil ways?
I remember one time, long time ago, there was this Catholic priest called Father Greif. One time he stopped me in the middle of the village. I was really young, and he said, "You know, Steve, there's something about this place. There's something in this village. There's something here." He said, "But I can't figure it out." I didn't realize until later on, and you know, when I became an adult, what he was talking about. He's talking about a spiritual thing. You know, all of us have a living soul. We have a spirit. You know, there's the physical and there's the spiritual world. And we're talking about things that we can't see.
Or at least we don't see very often sometimes.
Yeah. And the way that I learned these things is it's the Bible. And that's where you find the truth.
And you came to that a little bit later in life.
Yeah.
But you've told me before that your family very connected to the spiritual world.
Right. Well, in my family, from what I was told, there was history of like Anahkuk, medicine man. I really can't say who, but it was, you know, and I've shared with you some of my experience. I don't really want to say it over the radio or, I know it's real. This is not a game. These things are real. I mean, this is, I hope people understand it. You know, you got to have faith. You got to have faith in God, because from what I read, when I'm saying that this evil is real, is the only thing to protect you is God, is Jesus.
What is it about that spot between
Clark's and Eacock?
Clark's and Eacock. I hear everybody talk about this.
I don't know. I wish
they
could tell you. All I know is it's a place called the Lukaruyak, and I remember, well, I don't remember, but I was told that years ago it also used to be a village, I believe, at one time. But I've seen Bigfoot once, so a long time ago.
And you have no doubt about
No doubt about Bigfoot.
And no doubt about little people.
Well, I wouldn't say doubt, but, you know, I've heard this from my parents and from others, and then to hear about Chinxiaks, the little people, not only from Clark's, but from other villages within Alaska, other areas. So there's got to be some truth to it, but all I know is that they're evil. Evil. You're talking Halloween. They're evil.
Again, that was our friend Steve Wassily, and a big thanks to him and all of those who shared stories with us for this week's episode of Bristol Bay and Beyond. We'll be back in a moment.
He's there.
Knock, knock.
He's there.
Philip.
Philip who?
Philip my bag of candy.
You're listening to the Halloween episode of KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Well, what about medicine men and shamans? I suppose they're not really Halloween spooky, but as far as traditional lore and quite a few stories relate, medicine men work closer in concert with a spiritual world in a way that could frighten a great many of us who wouldn't understand it. The shaman's role in the village has been well told in traditional history and also well documented by a number of curious outsiders. Here's Tim Troll again, reading the first-hand account of Dr. J.H. Romig, a Moravian missionary and doctor in western Alaska around the beginning of the 1900s.
Shamans not only have the power to secure the favor of a spirit and make a man a good hunter, but they have the power to bring on the punishment by any spirit. Accordingly, if one is an undesirable person in the locality, or does things contrary to the good of the people, the people may secure the help of the shaman and bring on the offender, the ill will of evil spirits.
Okay, so that is a little spooky. I suppose nobody wanted the shaman to unleash evil spirits on their health or hunting or other well-being. But as to looking to the medicine man for guidance, well, here's a story our late friend Ofi Olson told us early last summer about that very subject. The story dates to the 40s, when Togiak, he told us, was just a small village. Ofi, as many remember, was a great storyteller. This one was handed down to him by George the Greek, and the story began as three men embark on their annual trip from Togiak to Bethel.
Every fall after fishing, he'd go up to the Bethel area and do some trading, probably nets and maybe a few groceries. And they left the latter part of August. And Peter Krause, he'd go up and make that trip every year. Him and Ingwal and Apasak. Time went by. They were gone for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Chris Peterson's wife, which is Apasak's cousin, was getting worried about them. She tells Chris, better get the medicine man, see where if you could find him. So Chris Peterson stopped by George and said, you want to watch somebody make medicine? And then Chris went and get Lupang, the medicine man. Name was Lupang. So he come over there and he wanted the man's hat, he wanted his shirt, pants, just how you like you dress a person. And so he laid it out on the floor like that. And then he had a big sealskin blanket. He went under that blanket and he said, I'm going to see if I could locate him up to the west here. He was under there for a little while. They could hear him making medicine. Pretty soon he come out. Can't find him, he say. So then he says, let me try. Maybe they bypassed Togiak and went to Dillingham. He said, let me try over the east side. He was under there a long time. He come back out and his face was long. He says, no, I can't find him. Apostle's relation, Chris Peterson's wife, start to cry. You know, she thought they were gone. Everybody encouraged him, try one more time. So he went under the blanket and he stayed there a long time. He told him he's going to try a little close to Togiak. George said you could hear him really making medicine, all kinds of noise under there. And pretty soon he come out of the sealskin blanket and he was smiling. And he told him, he says, I found him. I found him. He says, they were drinking on board. Two guys had a fight, and one guy fell overboard, but they got him back. He said, they'll be here in the morning. Nice weather in the morning, he said, they'll be here. So George, he got up early, him and Frank, and they walked on the beach. Here's a boat coming up, Togiak, southwest. So they come closer, they put the boat on the beach there in Togiak. And George says, you guys were drinking? Ingwald say, how you know? He says, well, two of you guys were fighting. Yeah, Ingwald say, them two fighting over there, and one fell overboard. I grab him by the head and pull him on board. He never drowned. And Ingwald looked at George and he says, how the hell you know? He says, we found out. We found out.
You can see that twinkle in Ofi's eye when you hear him telling that story. The role of medicine men has diminished, but have they and their profession gone away altogether? Well, this next story suggests maybe so. It's called The Death of the Last Medicine Man and was authored by Mike Hosseth in 1975. It was told to us here by June Ingram.
People used to be afraid of the medicine men. They didn't like to have him around too long for fear they might get mad at someone and put a hex on them. One of the medicine men, George Mason, was out at the hospital, Knacknack Hospital, with heart trouble, and they told him that he was going to die. He went around town asking some people if they would take him home to Igushik because he couldn't die here. He wanted to die at home. Nobody would take him home because the weather was bad, and they were afraid something might happen to them. Some people told him to go and see my mother, because she wasn't afraid. He went to see mother, and she asked me if I would take him home in my airplane. I thought about it for a while, and I decided I had better, because it was so important to both mother and the medicine man. On our way to Igushik, there was a whiteout, and we crashed by the mouth of Snake River. That was the last I remembered. 5 days later, I was picked up staggering like a drunk on the tundra below Kanaknak. My head was split open, and I had a rod through my hand. I was in the hospital for 15 days, of which I remember very little. When they found my plane, the medicine man was laid out on the wing with a tarp over him. He had died from a heart attack, and evidently I had laid him out and covered him up, but I don't remember it at all. I will always carry the scars of that accident.
Thanks, June Ingram, for sharing that story, which was told by Mike Hosseth to the Dillingham High School folklore class back in 1975. Well, I bumped into a more modern medicine woman this week, she being Dr. Kathy Hyman from the Kanakanak Hospital. Offhandedly, I asked Dr. Hyman if she had any specific medical advice to offer related to the frightful weekend ahead, and she said, sure.
Spiders. I mean, after all, people are always worried about spider bites, but honestly, there's no poisonous spiders in Alaska that cause bites that we have to worry about. Bats, on the other hand, are quite possibly infected with rabies. So I just heard a recommendation that if you awake in a room and find that there is a bat in the room with you, you could have been bitten without your knowledge and without it leaving a mark. I'm not quite sure how that happens, but that's what that particular story said.
No. Really?
Really. Now, I don't know for sure if the bats in Alaska are afflicted with rabies, but there are a reservoir of rabies in the lower 48.
This might be the scariest part of the show tomorrow. So, okay, no poisonous spiders. We don't know about bats. What else?
Well, everybody's worried about black cats on
Halloween. Black cats, sure.
Yeah, cat bites can be nasty. If you get a cat bite on your hand, it's important to get onto the right antibiotics fairly quickly, because the bacteria carried in a cat bite can be quite serious.
Okay. What if you're on the wrong end of a zombie apocalypse?
There is a website in the CDC that talks about the preparations that you should take for zombie apocalypse.
No.
Yes, sir, there is.
Our government at work.
Indeed. It's actually for mass catastrophes and could be applied equally well to tsunami or volcano or earthquake.
And what is the recommendation?
The usual stuff. Have drinking water on hand. Have food for several days on hand. Be prepared to live without help from the outside world.
So the other thing, you know, we've got little people, hairy man, the big bird, the long-nailed lady, and lake monster, and other unknowns and local legends. Should you have an unfortunate encounter, what would you recommend, Doctor?
It would depend on what injuries you sustained. Human bites are probably as bad, if not worse, than cat bites. So, if you have a human bite, you need to come get seen. And you, of course, should get your tetanus updated if you receive a bite or a scratch from any of those creatures.
Now, the one thing that I feel fairly certain that medically all people will encounter this weekend will be probably some sort of overindulgence in sugary treats. Any recommendation on that?
Yes, indeed. Be sure you follow your sugary treats with a toothbrush and toothpaste. And, you know, once in a while, overdoing the chocolate, not so bad. All the time overdoing the chocolate, you better be out on the road walking to burn off those calories. It's rather astonishing to me that my most tasteful candy, Giant Chewy Sweet Tarts, 40 calories per Giant Chewy Sweet Tart, that to burn off one package of 4 Giant Chewy Sweet Tarts takes me 12 minutes on the elliptical.
I'm going to find a soundbite that does like the wah, wah, wah. Well, Dr. Kathy Hyman, we promised not to submit this interview to the Harvard Medical School for further review, but thank you for the good medical advice this spooky weekend.
You are most welcome.
You're listening to Bristol Bay & Beyond's special Halloween episode. We'll be back in a moment after these elementary school youngsters tell us what they're going to dress up as this weekend.
A Native American princess. a ninja.
What are you going to be for Halloween?
Black Vader.
Hero. Admiral. Doctor.
Who's excited about Halloween over here?
Me.
What are you going to be?
I'm going to be a shadow woman.
I'm going to be a black cat. I'm going to be, a person from Star Wars.
Being Elsa for Halloween.
Can you sing the Frozen song?
I don't want to. Probably an army person or a zombie.
Anybody dressing up for Halloween at this table? You are?
A princess.
Be a princess? What are you going to be?
I forgot its name, but I think it's this greatest goddess costume.
Cool.
Elsa.
I don't know yet.
Don't know yet?
A candy fairy girl.
Who are you going to be?
Princess Penelope.
Ice princess.
A Ghostbuster.
Darth Vader.
Hello, my name's Owen.
What are you going to be for Halloween, Owen?
Bumblebee.
Huh? Yeah. Gonna be for Halloween there?
A stormtrooper.
Which one?
Boba Fett.
Why?
I like him.
Let's turn north now to a ghoulish story that Gary Nielsen of Kakanak has been retelling to groups of thoroughly spooked youngsters for years. This is the story of Stukpak, the Long Nail Lady. And whether you believe Stukpak is real and still out there or not, well, you're going to hope the tree branches aren't scraping against the window tonight. You're going to be glad to see you have enough food in your pot, and you might just kiss your kids one more time before you put them to bed. Here's Gary Nielsen's telling of the origin of Stukpak.
Long time ago, this family lived out by themselves. It was a mother, father, and two kids. They lived out, and over time, game started getting scarce. And the man or the husband would spend a long time out hunting, and he wouldn't be home much, and there was very little game. They were down to eating just about anything that they could get, like little fish and mice. And then they ran out of that and started eating old hides and hoofs, whatever they could get. And one day the husband said he was going to go out. He was going to be gone for a long time. He was going to go as far as he could to find game. And the wife said that would be okay. So he took off out hunting. And the woman was boiling some old bones. And as she was stirring it, some hot water splashed onto her finger and it burnt it. So she started sucking it, sucking on the burn. And it tasted good. So she burnt it some more and sucked on it some more until after a while there was no more finger left. She kept on doing that until both her arms were gone, just the bones. And she figured, well, I can't keep doing this because there won't be nothing left of me. And her kids were outside playing. So she turned out her oil lamp and she called one of her kids in. And they came and they couldn't see her. They said, come over here close to the fire. I want to see you. I want to see what you look like. So the kid came over and she clunked him over the head and threw him in the pot and cooked him up. And she ate him, and he tasted really good. And they say because it's human flesh, you just can't get enough of it. And she was still hungry. So she called her other child in, and she did the same thing. Got him close to the fire, clonked him over the head, cooked him up until there was nothing left. And because it was human meat, she wanted more. So she started on her toes and worked her way up to her thighs until she realized that she couldn't go on, or otherwise there would be nothing left of her either. She said, well, since I can't eat too much more of me, I'll eat the marrow out of my bones. So she drilled small holes into her legs and sucked the marrow out after she cooked it. Then she did the same thing to both her arms. Drilled small holes in her arms, cooked them, and sucked out the marrow, the buttock. And because there was no marrow, her body wouldn't operate right. So she filled up her bones with small pebbles and gave it a weight so she could move around. And when she was done with that, her husband came back home unexpectedly, a little early. And he noticed that the guzkik, or their house, was dark. And he didn't hear the kids playing. So he stood outside wondering what was going on. And he called to them. And his wife answered, but she sounded strange. And he said, where are the kids? She said, they're in here. What are they doing? He said, they're sleeping. No, he said, it's too early. Where are they? He said, come in and I'll show you. And just when he was ducking down to go into the house, he could hear this rattle. And he knew what the rattle was because they would make toys like that when they were younger. They put pebbles in bones for rattles. And he backed out and he said, what's wrong with you? And she said, nothing. Come on in. But he wouldn't. He got spooked after his kids wouldn't answer. So he took off. And she went after him because she knew he wasn't coming in. And she chased him and chased him and chased him for days until he finally got away. And the way he got away was she found somebody else's kid and she cooked him and ate him, something that nobody's kept on going. And they say that any kid that's all by themselves, you have to watch out for Stookbuck, because she refused to cut her fingernails or her hair. And she left her fingernails get really long so that when she caught a kid, she'd just be able to cut them up with her fingernails and cook them and eat them. So if you're out in the woods or out in the tundra and you hear a bone rattle, you got to get away because Tookbuck's chasing you, looking for you.
That's the story of Stookbuck, the traditional version courtesy of Gary Nielsen of Kakanak, but he wouldn't let me off the phone without telling me one more part to that story.
Here in Kakanak, about 10 miles up the bay, a couple of guys used to stay up there year-round. And this guy who lived here, who had a small kid, about 4 or 5 years old, would go up there and visit them once in a while. And he went up there to visit, and he took his boy with him. And they were inside the cabin visiting, and the boy had to go to the bathroom. And he said, yeah, we'll just go ahead and go right off the porch. And the kid went out, but he came right back in. He said he didn't want to. He was scared. And he got kind of upset. He said, just go outside and go to the bathroom. But he wouldn't. He stood there in the doorway, and he messed himself. And he got all upset. He said, why'd you do that? He said, there's an old lady out there I'm scared of. He said, what old lady? He said, he's standing behind the steam bath. She's really ugly. She has long, ugly hair, and her stooks are just really long. They're sharp-looking. And this was just like in the past 20-some years.
So she's still out there?
I guess.
It's strange. Sure is strange. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Two rabbits running in the ditch.
Cole Jewell, 5th grade. The bus stop. Ed Cox was driving home from work in the rainstorm. While he waited for a traffic light to change, he saw a young woman stand alone at the bus stop. She had no umbrella and was soaking wet. Are you going toward Farmington, he called. Yes, I am, she said. Would you like a ride home? I would, she said, and she got in. My name is Joanna Finney. Thank you for rescuing me. I'm Ed Cox, he said, and you're welcome. On the way, they talked and talked. She told him about her family and a job and she had gone to school. And he told her about himself. By the time they got to her house, the rain had stopped. I'm glad it rained, Ed said. Would you like to go out tomorrow after work? I'd love to, Joanna said. She asked him to meet her at the bus stop since it was near her office. They had such a good time. They went out many times after that. Always they would meet at the bus stop, and off they would go. Ed liked her more each time she saw her. But one night, when they had a date to go out, Joanna did not appear. Ed waited at the bus stop for almost an hour. Maybe something is wrong, he thought, and he drove to her house in Farmington. An older woman came to the door. I'm Ed Cox, he said. Maybe Joanna told you about me. I had a date with her tonight. We were supposed to meet at the bus stop near her office, but she didn't show up. Is she all right? The woman looked at him if he said something strange. I am Joanna's mother, he said slowly. Joanna isn't here now. But why don't you come in? Ed pointed to the picture on the mantel. That looks like her, he said. It did once, her mother replied. But that picture was taken when she was your age, about 20 years ago. A few days later, she was waiting in the rain at the bus stop. A car hit her and she was killed.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. You better stop the things you do. I ain't lying. No, I ain't lying.
It was this month, 13 years ago, that Southwest Alaska found itself in the news for sightings of a giant winged creature. Here's our friend Tim Troll again, relating an article from the Anchorage Daily News on the 2002 sightings of what might have been the Thunderbird.
Pilot John Bowker said he was highly skeptical of reports of this great big eagle that is two or three times the size of a bald eagle. But early this week, while flying into Manicotic, Bowker, owner of Bristol Bay Air Service, looked out his left window, and 1,000 feet away, there's this big, big bird, he said. The people in the plane all saw him, Bowker said. He's huge. He's huge. He's really, really big. You wouldn't want to have your children out. Nikolai Alakiak, a freight and passenger driver from Manicotic who was flying with Bowker, said the creature looked like an eagle that was as large as a little super cub.
Okay, so that story, well, it went pretty much everywhere in the news, and it earned more than a few skeptics, even locally. It was a stellar sea eagle, a vagrant from Russia, said some scientists. But here's the thing. A lot of people saw it that fall. A lot. Inconveniently, those sightings were 5 years before the release of the iPhone, or I'm sure we'd have all the proof we need, because who's ever flown with John Bowker when he's not fiddling with his phone as much as he's flying the plane? Thunderbirds have been sighted elsewhere in the lower 48, too. In one famous incident in Lawndale, Illinois, in 1977, a pair of Thunderbirds swooped in on three boys. 10-year-old Marlon Lowe was picked up by one of the birds and carried some 40 feet before the bird dropped him on account of his struggling and his mother's cries, depending on whose version of the story you believe. Yupik tradition offers some clues to the origin of the bird spotted in 2002, which Troll related in his Our Story program on the subject.
The bird could very well have been Mutukhovik, or Tungmeyakpak, pardon my Yupik, a thunderbird. Yes, a very long time ago, there were many giant eagles or thunderbirds living in the mountains, but they all disappeared, according to Yupik legend, except a single pair, which made their home on the mountaintop overlooking the Yukon River, near a village then called Sebenitsky. The top of this mountain was round, and the thunderbirds had hollowed out a great basin on the summit, which they used for their nest. From their perch on this rocky wall, these great birds would soar away on their broad wings, looking like a cloud in the sky. Sometimes to seize a reindeer from some passing herd, they would circle out, with a noise like thunder from their shaking wings and descend upon a fisherman in his canoe on the surface of the river, carrying man and canoe to the top of the mountain. There the man would be eaten by the young thunderbirds, and the canoe would lie bleaching among the bones and other refuse scattered along the border of the nest.
So as the story goes, that pair of thunderbirds continued to prey on hunters and fishermen and were more or less unstoppable, and the people lived in great fear and were not eating well on account. One day, the beautiful wife of one great young hunter went to fetch water at the river while her husband was away. One of the thunderbirds plucked her from the river's edge, and she was never seen again. When the hunter returned and learned of his wife's demise, he was inconsolable and filled with great rage. He climbed the thunderbird's mountain. The adults were away from the nest, but he slayed all of their young fledglings with his bow and arrow. Troll picks up the rest of the story from here.
With heart still burning for revenge, the hunter sheltered himself by a great rock near the nest and waited for the parent birds. The old birds came. They saw their young lying dead and bloody in the nest, and uttered such cries of rage that the sound echoed from the farther side of the great river as they soared up into the air, looking for the one who had killed their young. Very quickly, they saw the brave hunter by the great stone, and the mother bird swooped down upon him, her wings sounding like a gale in the spruce forest. Quickly fitting an arrow to a string as the eagle came down, the hunter sent it deep into her throat. With a hoarse cry, she turned and flew away to the north, far beyond the hills. Then the father bird circled overhead and came roaring down upon the hunter, who at the right moment crouched close to the ground behind the stone, and the eagle's sharp claws struck only the hard rock. As the bird arose, eager to swoop down again, the hunter sprang from his shelter and, with all his strength, drove two heavy war arrows deep under its great wing. Uttering a cry of rage and spreading abroad his wings, the thunderbird drifted away into the clear sky of the Northland, never to be seen again. Perhaps until now. There are many mysteries in the Northland, many mysteries that science cannot explain, many things that people saw hundreds of years ago that we don't see now. So, just to be safe, look up when you go outside your house, and if you hear thunder, and if you see a shadow on the ground of a great big bird, a bird as big as a small super cub, or with wings as long as a Cessna 207, hurry. Get back inside as soon as you can.
Knock, knock. Who's there?
Be.
Be who?
Beware, tonight is Halloween.
I have another one.
All right, huh? That was a pretty good one,
though. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Be.
Be who?
Beware, tonight's Halloween.
Oh,
that's what I said.
No, he said tonight's Halloween. I said tonight's Halloween.
Semantics. We have just enough time to revisit one more legend, but briefly. While I had Gary Nielsen from Kakanak on the phone this week, I had to ask, of course, about the Iliamna Lake Monster.
There's not just a lake monster. There's like four or five different types out there. Some of them probably are just big fish, like big lake trout or big pike. Some are probably sturgeon. And then there's other ones that we have no idea what they could be. And we have seen, myself and my family, we've seen what looked like big fish. We have seen what looked like sturgeon. We have seen what looked like sharks. We have seen what looked like a floating tree, but it dove and never came back up. So I don't know. One of the stories that my wife's grandmother told was way back when she was a little girl. They were camping down by Lower Tularik in the summertime, and it was a really hot summer day. And the caribou came down to cool off, and we're out in the water, and this big bull went out a little further than the rest of the caribou. And they said it was a good-sized bull, and this lake trout came killed it and ate it. And they said it was a lake trout. Not a monster, but a great big lake trout.
Well, that's it. That's our special Halloween episode of Bristol Bay and Beyond. Now, what say you, listener? Skeptical of the existence of mythical creatures among us, or maybe a little more cautious where and when you strike out on a dark night? Some say the legends help explain away other things that are tough to address or hard to understand, like why people go missing and disappear here. Others speculate the legends appeared to a time and a people more connected to the earth and the spiritual world. Gary Nielsen says,
every legend has a grain of truth to it, or is true. You know, some of it might have been used for keeping kids under control, but a lot of it that I used to scoff at, I no longer scoff at. I spent too much time outside and watched too many things happen to have any other explanation.
I suppose the truth is out there. If you make it till then, dear listener, we hope you join us again next week for another Bristol Bay and Beyond here on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. See you then, and happy Halloween.